You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the European Union will not arm Syria's rebels, or will it? An arms embargo remains in place, but there are loopholes. We'll work out what they are. In Paris, the race to be the next mayor of the French capital is already underway. All the major candidates are women and the stakes are high.
It's considered by many to be the sort of the springboard to the presidency. If you get this one, like Jacques Chirac did, you can end up being the president of this country. So it's very important. Four leading ladies, two to the left and two to the right. It's extremely interesting.
Forget Dubai and Doha, Oman believes it can become the Gulf's main arts hub. We'll find out why. And some diamonds have been stolen.
When they took the parcels of diamonds out of their security van, which is parked right by an aeroplane, a couple of cars burst through the security barrier and drove straight up to the plane. Eight people jumped out and the whole thing was carried out in a few minutes and then they disappeared.
There'll be music, there'll be laughter. I can't promise love or romance, but still, stay with us over the next hour for Midori House. So, as ever, rather a lot to pack in over the next 60 minutes. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Shia Muslims in Pakistan have agreed to end 4 days of protests after mass arrests were made over the weekend's sectarian bomb attack. 170 people have been detained over the bombings in the city of Quetta, which killed 89. Grieving relatives had refused to bury the dead, protesting what they said was the failure of security forces to protect them from militant Sunni groups. Protests have also spread to Afghanistan. In Kabul, demonstrators said they wanted to show solidarity with Shias across the border.
We demand that the Pakistani government to seriously take action against the terrorist organization, especially the Lashkar Jhangvi and Sipahi Sabha, and beside that, to seriously take action and protect the innocent Hazaras in Quetta, Pakistan.
The funeral has taken place of River Steenkamp, the girlfriend of the South African athlete Oscar Pistorius. He, meanwhile, has appeared before a court in Pretoria to deny murdering her. Pistorius said he loved her and mistook her for an intruder. Senior state prosecutor Tello Motuang says if convicted of murder, he is unlikely to be spared a life sentence.
A minimum sentence legislation requires that person be sentenced at least to life imprisonment, unless he or she is able to adduce substantial and compelling circumstances which convinces the court that the court should deviate from the prescribed minimum sentence.
A French soldier has been killed during the operation against militants in Mali. The soldier from the French Foreign Legion died in fighting in the north of the country. It's the second French fatality since the start of the operation in Mali last month. Meanwhile, seven French tourists have been kidnapped in Cameroon. The French President François Hollande says all were from the same family. It's thought at least three are children. They were captured near the border with Nigeria, where seven foreign nationals were kidnapped 2 days ago. Officials have blamed Nigerian extremists for the latest kidnapping. China has denied any involvement in large-scale cyber espionage after an American firm made accusations against a secretive branch of the country's military. It said the operation is based in Shanghai and had stolen vast amounts of data from more than 100 organizations around the world. But the Chinese government says it firmly opposes hacking and is itself a victim of cyber attack. The diamonds stolen in a huge heist at Brussels Airport are worth at least $50 million. But they would fit inside a shoebox. Authorities say the entire robbery lasted only 3 minutes. They're looking for eight men who is thought targeted a plane being loaded for a flight to Switzerland. The leaders of Malaysia and Singapore say a new high-speed rail link between the two nations will revolutionise business links. The line was agreed in talks between the two countries' prime ministers. Singapore's Lee Hsien Loong says it is a huge step forward.
It will change the way we see each other. It's the way people in London and Paris are able to think of it really as twin cities where you can commute, go up there, do business, meet friends, have a meal, and come back all within maybe two-thirds of a day.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. It's 18.05 here in London, 13.05 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. To arm or not to arm? That is the question facing the European Union when it comes to the level of support they're willing to give to the various rebel entities fighting the Assad regime in Syria. The answer, it seems, is to sort of arm. The EU embargo remains in place with some caveats. Those caveats will allow what some are calling a broader range of resistance to the Syrian rebels. The UK wanted to go further. To a certain extent, so too did the French. Monocle contributor and University of Birmingham professor Scott Lucas joins me now. Scott, the embargo has been extended for another 3 months, but it is slightly more complicated than that, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, first of all, on the open level, the European countries agreed that we could talk about non-lethal aid being provided to insurgent-held areas. Now, what non-lethal aid means is a little bit flexible. So, for example, you can provide, of course, aid to help out with people who have been rendered homeless or who have lost livelihoods from the conflict. But you can also provide non-lethal aid to the insurgents in terms of basics like clothing or, you know, non-military equipment such as communications equipment that they need in the field. But the story beyond the story, and the one that's not publicly admitted, is that some European countries and the Americans have been working with Arab states and Turkey, especially Saudi Arabia, to provide lethal aid. In other words, they're already providing weapons to the insurgents. They're just not saying this openly. What would have happened if the EU had lifted the embargo on weapons to the insurgency is that, in other words, they could have admitted publicly what they're already doing privately.
You mentioned there Saudi Arabia and also Qatar as well as supposed to be supplying these rebels with arms. I mean, it is just the issue here that the European Union, the US, is quite happy to give the rebels as much support as they need. They just don't really want to have to talk about it or to necessarily have their fingerprints all over it.
I think you're getting close to that. It's a double game. And what has complicated the situation right now is that nominally people are still talking about negotiations between the opposition, such as the group, the National Coalition, and the Syrian regime. Now, those talks about negotiations aren't really getting very far. I think they're more feints rather than, you know, real moves to discussion. But you still can't be seen to undercut those, which is what would happen if the EU said, no, we're arming the insurgents. They'd be accused of undermining the political process. You play the double game, however, which is while this goes on in public, in private, you maintain pressure on the Assad regime. The question, I think, is not whether they're providing military aid quietly or supporting the Saudis and the Qataris in providing military aid. It's how far do they go? Are they actually providing aid for a final offensive, say, on Damascus or a move on Aleppo? Are they providing just enough military aid where the insurgents can keep pressure on Assad without actually defeating his military?
Do they know exactly who it is that they're arming?
They're trying to get to that. This story's been going on for months. In summer 2012, there was actually a center established in Turkey, a command center, if you will, where the American CIA, European agencies, including British intelligence agencies, and Arab agencies and the Turks all sat down together and said, okay, do we give arms to this group or do we give it to this faction? They couldn't agree on which faction they wanted to support. The Saudis had some favored brigades. The Qataris had some favored brigades. The Turks had their favorites. What has changed in the last couple of months is that they've begun to agree, or at least they think they've agreed, on which brigades they favor getting the really big equipment. And the story is, at least what the Americans are privately saying is that the arms are going to the moderates, not to the Islamists, certainly not to this so-called terrorist brigade called Jabhat al-Nusra, but to elements of the Free Syrian Army.
And when we look at where it goes on from here, I mean, is it possible to just carry on as we are with this sort of, you know, song and dance of, oh, don't worry, we're not really arming, we're giving non-lethal aid, but behind the scenes we are, and just hope that, you know, this leads somehow to the downfall of the Assad regime? Or at some stage, do they have to say, you know what, either we're quitting this and we're going all in on peace talks, or we're going to be open about it and say, look, this is the group we're backing, and these are the weapons they need?
I think you've actually anticipated the key questions. I think the first thing to watch for is for a final declaration that we're not going to get anywhere with negotiations, that there's no chance of a transitional government with Assad stepping down, which is the minimum for a deal with the insurgency. And so a political solution is off the table. I think the second thing to watch for is that the Americans, and I suspect the British, actually want Assad to be toppled by a coup or by some element within the regime turning against him. And they're hoping that the insurgent pressure leads to that. Now, if the Assad regime does not crack to that point, in other words, if Assad and his brother, who commands an elite unit, remain in place, then do they get to that point you've identified? Do they actually support an all-out insurgent campaign which goes into the capital, goes into Damascus? Because the risk is that you don't get a quick, decisive victory, as happened in Libya in 2011, but that you get a more muddy, bloody campaign, such as you have in Aleppo, Syria's largest city right now.
Scott Lucas, a professor at Birmingham University, we'll leave it right there. Thank you very much indeed. Up next, we head to Paris, where politics has turned into an all-female affair.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we fight off the paparazzi and lose the entourage to chat with one of Japan's biggest pop stars. Get keen on Kino at the Berlin Film Festival and take a trip to that unlikely art enclave, Tasmania, you devils.
We had a drummer who was submerged in the Derwent and playing underwater for 15 minutes, thrashing away with metal drumsticks on a kit that had hydrofoams on it with a scuba mask on.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalizing the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on Monocle.com.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's just about to turn 1914 in Paris, 1814 here in London. The race to become the next mayor of Paris may be just over a year away, but the main candidates are already making themselves known. Bertrand Delanoue is stepping down after three relatively successful terms, and we already know one important thing about his successor. It is almost certain to be a woman, Paris's first female mayor. Anne Hidalgo, the choice of Delanoue, is the Socialist Party's unchallenged candidate, while the Greens are likely to turn to current Housing Minister Céline Duflot. Two candidates are lining up to lead the right-wing UMP ticket too, again, both of them female. Our Paris correspondent Tom Burgess-Watson is outside Hôtel de Ville, the building which, in a year's time, will have a new occupant.
Yes, it certainly looks that way, and very likely a new female occupant, and that'll be an absolute first in the history of the city. But when you're standing in front of Hôtel de Ville and you look up at the building, as I am now, it is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of mayor of Paris is. It's considered by many to be the sort of the springboard to the presidency. If you get this one, like Jacques Chirac did, and he held on for it to this job for 18 years, you can end up being the president of this country. So it's very important. And we've got all these candidates that have suddenly put their hats in the ring, and it's looking extremely interesting. Four leading ladies, two to the left and two to the right. It's extremely interesting.
Now, as you say, the main candidates all are all likely to be female. Who are the individuals that really stand out for you?
Well, I should just add that one man could still appear. We don't know who, and no one has said they will yet, but that could still happen, but very unlikely now. But the polls are certainly giving a rather steady individual their sort of endorsement at this stage. It's still very, very early. We're still, as you said, 13 months ahead of actual decision date. But this lady, Anne Hidalgo, is considered to be the favourite. She's a socialist who's been groomed up in her capacity as deputy mayor, very much in there with François Hollande, a good friend of his. And she's a bit of a veteran, really, compared to the others who are quite a lot younger. She's 53. And the question is, I think a lot of people will be wondering, does she have the flair and the charisma to match the other people who are, as I said, much younger? You've got Cécile Duflot, who is the housing minister right now. She's in the Green Party. She hasn't actually said she's definitely in the race, but she's definitely not excluded it. She said that much. But then the most interesting characters are these two arch rivals on the right of the political spectrum. You've got this aristocratic lady, Nathalie Kosciusko-Morizet. She's a glamorous, old-school individual, although she's still very young. She's only 39, and she's known as NKM here in France because her name is so long and complicated that no one can quite get it out. And she comes from a sort of dynastic family. And she's now running neck and neck with Rachida Dati, who's also very much at the right of the political spectrum. And she's currently the mayor of Paris's 7th arrondissement. And Rachida Dati is absolutely no stranger to controversy. She's rather racy, you might say, if you were being very polite. But there's no love lost between these two ladies. And it's extremely interesting to see that they are now having to run neck and neck, a bit like the two men running for the head of their party, the UMP, François Fillon and Jean-François Copé.
Now, I mean, you know, it's not just here in politics when we look at the mayoral race where there appear to be more female candidates than before. You've written an article for us in the new issue of Monocle, which comes out later this week, looking at how across all parts of French society at the moment, there appear to be more women in the top roles. Why do you think that is starting to happen now in France?
There's two roles where there hasn't yet been a woman. One is City Hall and the other is the presidency. Obviously, we've had a female prime minister before. But I think, you know, France is a country founded, as this logo blazoned above my head on City Hall says, on liberty, fraternity and equality. And I think there has been, as I mentioned in that article, a slight degree of window dressing in some rather more cynical people's eyes, that ticking boxes and having a nice sort of parity, 17 out of the 34 ministers being women. There are some accusations, a bit of finger pointing, that perhaps we're not quite there. There's still some way to go before there is true gender equality. And I suppose nothing would make that happen faster than a woman occupying City Hall right behind me and then ultimately being groomed up for the top job in the land. So that could happen. But France moving ahead very fast, and it's a country based on very much equal values and equal opportunities, and I suppose it's perhaps a surprise that France hasn't got there earlier in some people's eyes in terms of producing a female head of state.
A final word about Bertrand Delanoë, the current occupant of Hôtel de Ville, the current mayor of Paris. He's going to be stepping down next year. You know, you said before that often people use the mayoralty in Paris as a springboard to the presidency. What do you think lies next for Monsieur Delanoë?
He hasn't said very much about his ambitions. There was some rumblings that he was going to challenge Sarkozy last time around, and that didn't happen. And it leaked in the press, and if it was a plan, it was slightly spoiled by that leak. He's a very high-profile individual, and most people would say he's made a very important impact on Paris in his capacity as mayor. He's introduced all sorts of initiatives that have been copied by other mayors around the world, the bicycles that you see all around the world in towns and cities for free. It was really his idea, and France was a pioneer on that one. He's done a great deal for this city in most people's eyes, and he's a very colourful character. He's no stranger to controversy. There's been an assassination attempt on his life before when he was stabbed about 10 years ago. He's very known and very visible, and it would be extremely surprising if after his 12 very successful years as mayor, he disappeared into oblivion at his fairly young age, politically speaking, of 61. I'd be extremely surprised if we don't see him in a frontline position, and he's lining himself up for that behind the walls of the building I'm standing in front of.
Tom Burgess-Watson outside the Hotel de Ville, thank you very much indeed. It's 18:20 now here in London, and you're listening to Midori House. Now, picture the scene. An airport runway, a screech of tyres, the sound of a security fence being torn away by trucks, and heavily armed men helping themselves to a multi-million euro consignment of gems destined for transport from Antwerp to Zurich. It's Oscar season, so this is the elaborate plot of a blockbuster movie, right? Well, no, wrong. This was the extraordinary story played out at Brussels Airport earlier today as diamond thieves made off with more than 50 million euros of precious stones. So what does such a bold heist reveal about the security, or lack of it, that surrounds diamond trading? And how reliant is the whole business on the guaranteed safe passage of these cargoes through hubs like Antwerp, a city which sees an average of 150 million euros worth of gems pass through every single day? A man who knows is Harry Levy, president of the London Diamond Bourse. I caught up with Harry earlier and asked for his reaction to the news of this Hollywood action caper turned real-life crime.
Security, especially with large quantities of diamonds, is very, very tight these days. And in fact, from what I understand, they caught him at the weakest point, which was when they took the parcels of diamonds out of their security van, which is parked right by an aeroplane, to get onto the aeroplane, and apparently a couple of cars burst through the security barrier around the airport tarmac and drove straight up to the plane. 8 people jumped out with guns. But again, I said they seemed to have been very professional because they didn't fire any guns. Nobody was injured. And the whole thing was carried out in a few minutes and then they disappeared.
When you look at cases like this and the preventative measures that people take to try and ensure that this doesn't happen, has security surrounding the moving of diamonds developed much over the last few years?
It certainly has. As I said, that's why it's such a rare event for this type of thing to happen, especially for large quantities. I mean, most diamonds are now carried out by, you know, very good security companies like Brinksmat and G4. And various others. I mean, there aren't that many companies who do this, but they are very professional, and as I said, you know, it's very rare for them to be attacked.
What sort of measures do they take if one were to be moving a large shipment of diamonds by air? I mean, what are the sort of things that you'd be looking at to ensure that it happens safely?
Well, I imagine it's a fairly frequent thing that they do probably every day. The amounts involved are totally unknown. I mean, it could be a few million one day, and it could be more than the 50 million which we have today. My own feeling is that the robbers didn't know exactly what was in the shipment or how big the shipment was.
And now that they do appear to have this loot, they have a problem now of deciding what to do with it. How do they go about trying to resell them, and are there ways that they can be caught that way?
As far as I can make out, there seems to be two types of diamonds. One are rough diamonds, which are not polished, and they're not traceable at all. The other ones are polished diamonds. Now, a lot of these would have certificates with them, so they have a pedigree, and they know exactly what size they are, what shape they are, what weight they are, what sort of colour they are. And I imagine this sort of list would be circulated very quickly around the world. And dealing in diamonds, we know we'd be asked to look out for them. As far as the rough diamonds are concerned, they would probably go to one of the cutting centres, such as India, Israel, South Africa, New York, and I presume they would have had, you know, sorts of sources where they knew these stores were going to go to before they came out this heist.
That was Harry Levy, president of the London Diamond Bourse, sharing some pearls of wisdom with me a little earlier. Someone else who knows a little bit about this, although hopefully not too much.
Not too inside.
No, it's Tyler Brulé, who joins us in the studio. Tyler, when you've done a lot of stuff with Swiss before, they have a gold bullion flight, don't they? They take the security very seriously.
It was interesting when we were working with the creation of Switzerland's new national carrier in 2001-2002. So off the back of the bankruptcy of Swiss Air, we were very involved through our sister company Wink Creative in not just working on the main Swiss brand, but also Swiss World Cargo. And a massive element of what they do is of course all of their high risk, highly perishable, and certainly high value traffic. And once upon a time, you'd land at Zurich Airport and you'd see these little red trucks that would pull up, and you'd wonder, are these small fire trucks? What are they? And these were vehicles, and particularly on a Monday that we would talk about what would be the gold bullion run. So every morning, people sort of think that, of course, gold moves around the world, just digitally. No, it actually has to move from place to place. And it is not a Hercules aircraft with forklifts going in the back. Oftentimes, and as we've seen in Brussels today, it is in the hold of a regular aircraft, and certainly Swiss airlines. It's a big part of the revenue is transporting not just the likes of diamonds, but also valuable things like tuna bellies as well.
And it's funny, it's only when things like this happen, and they happen incredibly rarely. Mm. I mean, we were talking in the morning meeting today upstairs and trying to remember the last time there was something similar. And
a proper diamond heist. Yeah,
and it was possibly the attempt on the Millennium Dome, the massive diamond there, which failed because the gang was infiltrated. But that was 12, 13 years ago. Mm. But it's only when these things happen that we really think much about the security that goes in. And as you say, often, even if you are at Zurich Airport a lot, you probably won't really see exactly what's going on. Did you get a sense of sort of the behind the scenes security that they really that they pull out to ensure this doesn't happen?
Well, absolutely. And Swiss and former Swiss Air were very famous for not just the security that was on the passenger deck, the Swiss Tigers being their own version of air marshals, but also all of the security that goes on in and around the airport. And I think of course this was a Helvetic aircraft. It's a company which is affiliated with Swiss. They wet lease aircraft from them. They code share on certain flights. I think this is another big blow, though, for brand Switzerland. Of course, there's been a number of question marks about what happens with financial services in Switzerland and what happens with the state of banking. This has been a wonderful high margin area for the country, storing diamonds, storing art, etc. And now if they can't make this happen, albeit it was in Brussels, nevertheless. It was still inbound to Zurich.
It was, but I mean, there's nowhere else really for anyone to go. For anyone else to go, is there? I mean, you can't imagine. I mean, are there other candidates for potential places where you'd move all this stuff around?
No, I mean, I think our friends in Singapore would love to have a go at it. And Singapore is certainly trying to position themselves as a similar type of center in Asia or in Southeast Asia. But I think for the moment, Zurich probably feels pretty confident about things. But I imagine there's going to be a few raised eyebrows with clients from tomorrow.
Indeed. Tyler Brulé, thank you very much indeed. We're going to stick with diamonds just for a little bit. This is Kanye West with Diamonds from Sierra Leone. Before I beat myself up like Ike, you can still throw your rocker full of diamond tonight, because diamonds are forever. Throw your diamonds in the sky if you feel the vibe. Diamonds are forever. The rock is still alive every time I rhyme. Forever, ever. That was Kanye West with Diamonds from Sierra Leone, and producer Hannah Jenkins is rather excited that Kanye is going to be in London this weekend. In the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll find out about the burgeoning art scene in Oman, and we'll also take a peek into the business section in the new issue of Monocle. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the headlines.
Authorities in Pakistan have made a series of mass arrests in connection with the weekend's sectarian bomb attack in the city of Quetta. 89 people were killed. 170 have now been detained in connection with the strike. Shia Muslims, who had refused to bury their dead relatives in protest at what they said was the failure to protect them from militants, have now ended that demonstration. The funeral has taken place of River Steenkamp, the girlfriend of the South African athlete Oscar Pistorius. He, meanwhile, was appearing before a court in Pretoria where he denied murdering her. Pistorius insisted he mistook her for an intruder. A French soldier has been killed during the operation against militants in Mali. It's the second French military fatality since the start of the offensive last month. Meanwhile, seven French tourists have been kidnapped in Cameroon. The kidnapping has been blamed on Nigerian militants. China says it has no involvement in large-scale cyber espionage. It's after an American firm made accusations against a secretive branch of the country's military. But in the last hour, the White House has said that it has repeatedly raised the issue of cyber espionage with senior Chinese officials. And authorities say the entire diamond robbery at Brussels Airport last night lasted only 3 minutes. They're looking for eight men who are suspected of targeting a plane being loaded for a flight to Switzerland. The diamonds stolen in the robbery are worth at least $50 million. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. It's 18:32 here in London, 13:32 in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Doha has film, Abu Dhabi has the Louvre, Sharjah has the Biennial, and Dubai has the Art Fair. Yet, further down the Arabian coast, Oman is attempting to turn itself into the Gulf's premier arts hub. It has the Gulf's only opera house, a symphony orchestra, an arts festival, and now even its own fashion week. Elizabeth Dickinson, Gulf correspondent for The National, was in Muscat last week to cast her eye over Oman's cultural challenges, and she joins me on the line now. Beth, thank you for joining us on Midori House. Just how impressed were you with Oman's cultural offerings?
Actually really surprised. I mean, this is something that dates back a very long time in Oman's history, and you can feel it from really the moment that you walk, that you set foot in the capital. Oman has had a long history, 18th, 19th century, as sort of a hub throughout the region. The Omani Empire had branches or sort of controlled much of the Swahili coast down into East Africa, as well as on the Arabian Peninsula. So it was really a meeting point for so many different cultures. And that survives to this day. And what they've done in sort of a really creative and inventive way is taken that cosmopolitan history, taken that insight into the mixing of cultures, and really used it to create their own niche in emerging art. So, for example, I had the opportunity to attend Muscat Fashion Week, which I would recommend to anyone. It was a fantastic event. About 12 designers from throughout the region, and just a really brilliant mix of Arab, Indian, African style in a way that I really hadn't seen anywhere before. There was just so much new and so much creative thinking going on behind the event.
Now, you also got a chance to see the Royal Opera House. And I'm intrigued to see what you think of this, because I was there a couple of years ago for a report for the magazine, and it was just being built. It was almost finished. And I was talking to the director, who said, you know, this is the programme we've got lined up for the opening couple of months. But I must say my concern was it seemed like it had been built just because, well, why not? But without much thought as to what would actually go in it. Do you think that they've worked that out yet? Does it feel like an opera house that has a proper program that responds to the community it's in?
Definitely. Well, I'll tell you two stories that I think are really representative. I mean, the first one is simply the fact that the Opera House sold out its entire first season. So this was clearly catering to an audience that was not only local, but in addition, you know, to tourists, to expatriates, and really filling a gap for demand for this sort of fine art. You know, maybe one that no one even knew existed, but that's sort of telling of just the, you know, the demand that they were able to create. But it's not only that. When artists have come to the Opera House, they've been extremely impressed. So one recent example is Joshua Bell, very famous violinist, certainly among the top in the world. came to the Opera House and loved the performance so much that I understand that he may have asked to come back. So this is the sort of example, you know, when an artist sees a venue as a place where they really feel that they can express themselves, then they sort of can help create the reputation of the place in and of itself. Now, of course, because Oman is sort of out of the way for many traditional sort of classical music tourists or opera tourists, for example, they have to bring the best of the best. And this is exactly what I think they're trying to do.
Now, I'm intrigued in your take on Muscat itself, because as a city, it's certainly refused to go down the same route of Dubai and Abu Dhabi in terms of how it's been built. There are rules about how tall buildings can be. You know, most can't be over seven stories. Even the colours have to be a sort of a white or a beige or a pastel. There's no steel, there's no glass. And this all comes from Sultan Qaboos, the leader in Muscat. In Oman. Is that still working for the city, or do you get a feeling that there are certain developers that are sort of rubbing up against that and thinking, you know what, I kind of wish we could do this a little bit different?
Certainly there are tensions of that sort. I think recently, I think about 6 months ago, they actually changed the maximum building height, for example, from 7 floors to 9 floors. And this is just sort of a tension of the fact that developers have obviously become aware of the fact that their real estate is valuable and they'd like to build up. So in a way to sort of maximize their potential. But in the same way, I think that there is a sort of broader understanding that this is one of the things that makes Muscat unique within the Gulf. As you said, you know, they haven't gone the Dubai route, they haven't gone the Abu Dhabi route. And when I talked with the municipality, they were very clear that they don't want to go down that route, that they're much more content to sort of see a gradual evolution in a way that really guards this long tradition that they have, both as cosmopolitan, but also as very true to being just locally and local and Omani. And I think this really actually adds to the ambiance of the city as sort of a cultural atmosphere. I remember I had a very interesting conversation with one of the designers at Fashion Week from Saudi Arabia, and she said to me, you know, when I come here, I get so many great ideas because I look at the city and I see something unique, I see something very honest, in a way that maybe I don't see in other cities in the Gulf. So it creates sort of an atmosphere of originality and also inspires, I think, artists of this sort to really add to that and sort of look within their own experience for that equally original concept.
Beth Dickinson, we'll leave it there. Elizabeth Dickinson, Gulf correspondent for The National. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. Still lots to come, including Germany. All after this.
Europe's first big election of 2013 takes place next weekend as Italy goes to the polls. And on Monocle 24, we've got it covered. All this week, we'll be reporting from across Italy, getting under the skin of one of the continent's most fascinating countries. Every day on The Globalist and The Monocle Daily, we'll analyse the big issues and the even bigger personalities. That's the Italian election, all this week on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House, 1939 in Berlin, 1839 here in London. The new Deutschland-themed issue of Monocle hits newsstands on Thursday. Subscribers, of course, they'll have it all already. If you're not a subscriber, really, what are you doing? Monocle.com, find it all there. Now, to celebrate, we are looking at a different section of the magazine every day this week on Midori House. And today, we're looking inside the business section. And not just any old business, either. We're looking at the world of stationery. To prove that it's not just Monocle that looks good on paper, we dispatched our correspondents to all corners of Germany to visit brands who are still at the cutting edge of this sector internationally. Our senior editor, Sophie Grove, told our news editor, Tom Edwards, all about the contribution that likes of Montblanc, Faber-Castell and Schneider are still making to German business and culture.
So we're looking at the new issue of Monocle magazine. There's a lot about exploding these old myths about Germany, how challenging the stereotypes. But some of them remain very true, don't they? Particularly something about craftsmanship, attention to detail within industry and generally culturally. But I think within the business pages, there are particular stories that demonstrate that ongoing commitment.
I'm sort of entrenching some of the stereotypes of this feature. Our lead is about German stationery, looking at pencil factories, board marker factories, and also Mont Blanc, which is making these fine, fine nibs. We're really looking across the board. It's this sort of survey of the whole of the stationery industry in the whole of Germany. Beautiful still life on page 84. Really looking at the astonishing array of stationery that comes from Germany. You just don't realise that in more or less every pencil case, pen pot and stationery cupboard, it's just jam-packed with pens and pencils that are all manufactured in Germany. You know, in this era where there's such a flight of manufacturing to the Far East, especially with things like a humble pencil, you know, Germany has managed to cultivate this really interesting culture of sort of small businesses still making stationery.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because on one level, the kind of Luddite in you thinks it's new technology, everything's digital, these must be markets that are declining or contracting. But far from it, a lot of these big illustrious brands, the likes of Mont Blanc, Faber-Castell, Schneider, Stettler and the likes, they're going from strength to strength. Their markets are growing, their market shares are growing, and they're, you know, more profitable than they've ever been. What did you find about the financial health of these companies? Is it as robust a picture as we might have anticipated?
Well, I think what's interesting is that Germany is, I mean, it's got a very strong and robust domestic market, but it's also got a game plan in the sense that, you know, emerging markets where literacy is rising, they've sort of identified these markets and they're selling abroad too. Combined, the stationery industry in Germany was 602 million euros in 2011, which was up 2.1% the previous year. So what we're really seeing is a sort of, they've got a strategy. Having said that, we went to the most beautiful Bavarian castle where Count Faber-Castell is overseeing his pencil empire in Bavaria, and looking at the travails of that company, because pencils, they've had their ups and downs, really. You know, they've had to create this sort of premium pencil and innovate the pencil and try and sort of really find a luxury market, because they can't just rely on, you know, mass production. They have no, you know, they can't compete with the likes of China in those stakes. So what we've seen there is them going back into their archives, looking at the sort of heritage of the company, and then coming up with, you know, these incredible premium products. You can actually have a pencil made with your own horse's mane incorporated into the pencil. How about that?
I'll have to investigate that. I'll have to select one from my, you know, extensive holdings.
So that's clearly sort of looking for the sort of slightly more aristocratic side of the pencil market. But at the same time, you know, Faber-Castell is still making the majority of their products are for, you know, the artistic market. There's these incredible pictures, and actually the photographers did such an amazing job of capturing the sort of amazing colours of these places. And there's just this wonderful culture of experimentation and amazing machinery, but it just looks beautiful and it looks like this sort of nutty professors.
I just wondered, it's quite interesting looking at the pictures. As you said, you mentioned Count Anton Wolfgang von Faber-Castell in his grand drawing room. It looks like he's standing very austere looking. A lot of character and a lot of sort of attention to detail, which is very much about the personalising, as you mentioned before, with the sort of the horsehair. It's surprising perhaps because you might think again of Germany as being very exact. It would all be about cutting edge technology. It would all be very mechanised, you know, super industrialised. But there actually seems to be a real sense of valuing that traditional quality, the handmade, the fact that something of the character of some of these eccentric sort of German gentlemen comes through. They seem to treasure that as much as the, you know, exact industrial techniques.
Exactly. And what we saw at Mont Blanc in Hamburg, I mean, Mont Blanc has gone from this very, very small company creating these incredibly beautiful pens and nibs, really, to, you know, broadening out its scope. But in the workshops, it's still almost this incredible sort of silent, craftsman-like atmosphere, you know, really everything done by hand. Every pen is tested by hand with invisible ink. You can send your handwriting in to Mont Blanc and they will craft a pen to suit your character. So there's a sense that they're going back to the real roots of what they started with. And, you know, it's just so beautiful to see these sort of dark, incredible spaces with these real artisans working on each individual item.
Now, I have to ask you about, you mentioned Mont Blanc there. There's a picture of one of their products, a pen, I believe, inspired by Albert Einstein. It glitters with jewels, we learn. It's skeletonette design, intended to represent the space-time curve. Impressive enough, it's 125,000 euros. Will we see one in the Sophie Grove pencil case?
If only. Actually, I mean, it was so difficult editing this piece because, you know, what we looked at was so many incredible, you know, different companies. Pelican is one of my favourite, and also Lamy. You know, they make wonderful fountain pens, but really in a sort of 1980s, sort of slightly kind of that very Teutonic, streamlined, almost the kind of the equivalent to sort of a 80s Porsche or something. And they still have that aesthetic. We included some of their ink in the still life. And we should say that Germany and Japan are the two places that are really leading the stationery market and creating most of the stationery that we know of today. And it's amazing to see those two countries collaborating together. You know, Germany supplies a lot of nibs to Japanese companies. And then we're looking at Edding, we mentioned earlier. You know, their very first marker was made in a garage, like all great innovations, using Japanese ink. So there's that amazing cross-fertilisation. Two very unlikely markets really just dominating. And, you know, it's still staggering to see how total that is in terms of innovation.
And Sophie, just finally, I wanted to ask you about conflicts within these industries. We've seen, could we call it pencil wars?
It was pencil wars. And that was a challenge in editing the piece because they're very aware, each pencil house, especially the pencils, each stationery outfit is very aware of their competition and very wary of their competition. But for instance, the Faber-Castell outfit, they actually sued neighbouring Stadler for claiming to be the world's oldest pencil maker because actually there were some funny union laws around 1662 when Stadler set up shop in Bavaria. And actually, they skirted the rules at Faber-Castell by going outside the precinct and going into Stein, where in Nuremberg, where they are now. And they managed to claim to be the oldest pencil manufacturer and win. They banished Stadler. But it's so interesting to see how they're still very real, these pencil wars. Nobody has forgiven and forgotten, and they really have a beady eye on each other.
They do indeed. That was Sophie Grove talking to Tom Edwards, who has been doing his research on all things Germany because he is heading to Berlin tomorrow for... Well, actually, he's not doing a show tomorrow. He's frankly, I've no idea. I think it's essentially he's going there on holiday tomorrow. But on Thursday and Friday, he'll be doing two shows from Berlin. Midori House on Thursday, The Briefing on Friday. Do tune in for both of those. You're listening to Midori House. Now it's time for a roundup of this week's big aviation stories. A little earlier, Andrew Tuck caught up with Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight International magazine. They talked about the decline of business jet deliveries and, of course, the ongoing problems for Boeing with their 787 batteries.
This is fascinating stuff, even though batteries don't... wouldn't be the first thing to spring to mind when you say the word fascinating, but the battery has the whole issue of batteries has grounded the 787, as you probably know, the world's sort of most advanced newest passenger aircraft. The danger of a battery fire on board a Japanese aircraft caused the authorities and Boeing also to ground the entire fleet of around 50 of these aircraft. Now, while the authorities and Boeing are desperately trying to find out what the cause of this this fire on the battery was, Boeing, of course, use what are called lithium-ion batteries, which are a sort of new technology of batteries in aviation. Now, Airbus, on their rival A350, were also going to put in these lithium-ion batteries. And they've now switched. They've now said that they're going to go back to old-style nickel cadmium batteries, which are the type of batteries that power the auxiliary power on a lot of existing aircraft. Boeing have said they're going to stick with the lithium-ion batteries. So it's an interesting twist to this story that Airbus are, I guess, really hedging their bets in a way. They've been very careful to say they don't think that lithium-ion batteries are unsafe, but they're saying that as a precaution, as a risk reduction strategy, they're going to switch the battery technology to the old-style batteries.
Now, Murda, tell me, I understood that one of the reasons that the kind of airlines, or the aircraft manufacturers rather, were keen on these batteries is because they weigh a lot less. Is that correct?
Yes, they weigh less, and that's all part of the whole dreamliner, the 787 philosophy. It's all about creating an aircraft. There's a lot more electrics on this aircraft rather than hydraulics, and it's also the airframe itself contains a lot more composite materials, so plastics, rather than traditional metals. And that, of course, makes the aircraft lighter, which is great, but the real reason that Boeing want to build a lighter aircraft is to deliver 10 to 15% greater fuel economy, which in an era of high fuel prices can be the difference between viability and non-viability for an airline.
Now, Murdo, you've also pointed out this story, which shows that the delivery of business jets has actually halved since 2007, according to new statistics. What's behind all this then?
Yeah, this is figures that have come out from our sister company, Ascend Advisory, and they've been tracking the market very, very carefully. And last year's business jet delivery tally of there was 675 aircraft delivered worldwide in 2012. That's half the figure that was delivered in 2007, which was the height of the business jet boom, if you like. It had been growing up fairly steadily in the early part of the century, and 2007 was when it really peaked. Now that decline is really quite dramatic. It's not something that we saw in some other sectors after the financial crisis, where things collapsed very quickly but began to recover. What's happened in business aviation is that deliveries have collapsed and not really recovered at all. In fact, in some cases got worse since 2007. And it's kind of counterintuitive in a way, because the markets where there is a strong strong demand for business aviation, for business jets in emerging markets, in China, in Latin America, in the Middle East, these markets are actually growing for business aviation. So where it's really struggling is in the traditional markets of North America and Europe. And if you look at North America, the economy is not on its knees anymore, but we're not seeing that feeding through yet, that slow economic growth feeding through yet into business jet sales.
Now, do you think I wonder, just digging a little bit deeper, is that, you know, if you were in 2007, you were thinking about buying a jet, and then 2008 hits and there's the disaster of the financial crisis, and you kind of, you know, hold off and you cancel your order, then it's probably a couple of years before you go back in the market, and then it's a few years before it's actually made and a few more before it's delivered. So is there actually a kind of feeling that perhaps it just actually, once you have one of these big, massive fall-offs, it could take some years for it to kind of anyway naturally kind of come back up again, even when confidence does return to the market?
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and there's definitely a lag in this. I mean, remember, these figures are not business jet orders. These are business jet deliveries. So these are actually jets that were handed over and paid for in 2007. If you look at orders, there were a whole spate of companies on the confidence that was around at the time ordering business jets, which have now cancelled these orders, or in many cases the companies that ordered them are not even with us anymore. So that was even more dramatic. So this is just deliveries. But yes, I think if you look at the state of a lot of US corporations, you know, business jets became a bit of a dirty word around the financial crisis. They were seen, identified with, you know, fat cat executives. We had when the Detroit car industry bosses went to sort of beg for government aid in 2008, I think it was 2009, and were flew on their business jets. And of course, that was a huge faux pas on their part. So business jets have kind of become a bit of a dirty word. And there are companies in the US now which have become, you know, they've got a lot of cash reserves. And it would be logical, because flying business jets makes a lot of sense. If you're a highly paid executive, you do not want to be paying that executive to be hanging around in business class lounges waiting for his delayed flight or her delayed flight. You don't want them to be wasting time. You want them to be as efficient as possible. And nothing is more efficient than having a private plane that's going to take you from meeting A to meeting B to meeting C all in one day. They're incredibly efficient tools of business. But I think in America especially, and also in Europe, they've become a little bit tainted.
Murdo, could you just write all that down again and email it to me? Because I'm going to send that to our CFO and see if it will persuade her to let us finally put the order in.
Well, I'd be delighted to. You can always try. I'm trying to say it myself.
Okay, we'll go halves. We'll go halves.
Sounds good.
That was Andrew Tuck pushing his luck there with Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight International magazine. Time now for us to finish with our daily monologue. And in keeping with our theme on clothes, which, you know, we've been discussing a little bit, Fernando Augusto Pacheco weighs what every professional gentleman ponders each summer. Is it ever acceptable to wear shorts in the workplace?
It is that time of the year when people start thinking about what to wear for spring-summer, and magazines are already preparing their features on what fashions are acceptable. Of course, one of the favorite topics is shorts. Can you wear shorts in the city? The debate happens every year. Tom Ford famously said that shorts should only be worn on the tennis court or on the beach. I have to disagree with him on this one. When the mercury is rising, I don't see the problem in showing a bit of leg, even if you are in a work environment, or if you just want to stroll around in Seoul or São Paulo. Shorts can look quite elegant, if worn in the right way. Of course you should try to avoid coming to work wearing board shorts or the baggy sort. Well, if you insist, do it, but I could advise you to go for a nice pair of tailored shorts. Almost all major brands have shown a pair or two in their spring-summer 2013 collections. From Ralph Simons split shorts to Louis Vuitton Bermudas, there are plenty to choose from. Or failing that, you could also ask your tailor to make some for you. But for some reason, the case against shorts is still quite strong. Even in my tropical home country, Brazil, where to be honest with you, you could potentially wear shorts the whole year round, there are strict laws in workplaces, which mean you have to wear a suit or at least a formal shirt and trousers, no matter the temperature. I feel sorry for security guards who need to wear suits, even if it's almost 40 degrees outside. When I was a kid, I lived in the northeastern city of Natal for about a year and a half. For those who love the heat, Natal is a paradise. But there was one big problem. Students couldn't wear shorts in school. We all had to wear trousers. I always thought this was absurd, an unnecessary case of sartorial conservatism. And wouldn't you prefer to see a man wearing a lovely pair of shorts instead of suffering the heat, looking uncomfortable in his jeans? In some countries in the often chilly northern hemisphere, there aren't that many days when shorts are even an option. So when the sun does come out, make sure you step out and sashay about in your shorts, just like a gentleman would on the beaches of Rio. For Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And yeah, he does wear shorts all the bloody time. It's February, but he'll still do it. Anyway, there we are. That's all we've got time for on Midori House. Thank you to Hannah Jenkins, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Annabelle Bly, and also our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Section D is up next. Right after the news, Hugo will be joined by our creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell, to discuss illustrated maps.
It's always nice to see what an illustrator's take on Moscow is. You know, the little bits and bobs, the little people, the characters, the little finesses that they put on. As a reader, that's what stops you in your tracks. And yeah, you give that page an extra sort of 10 minutes of your time.
Stay with us for that. It's right after the news. We'll be back with Midori House same time tomorrow. For now, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.